There are currently three theories of the origin of the moon. 1. The moon originated at the same time as the Earth, being formed substantially from the same material, aggregating and solidifying. 2. The moon was formed not in the vicinity of the Earth, but in a different part of the solar system, and was later captured by the Earth. 3. The moon was originally a portion of the terrestrial crust and was torn out, leaving behind the bed of the Pacific. All three theories claim the presence of the moon on an orbit around the Earth for billions of years. Mythology may supply each of these views with some support. Genesis I for the first view, the birth of Aphrodite from the sea for the third view, Aphrodite's origin in the disruption of Uranus, and also the violence of Sin, the Babylonian moon, seems to support the second view. Since mankind on both sides of the Atlantic preserved the memory of a time when the Earth was without the moon, the first hypothesis, namely, of the moon originating simultaneously with the Earth and in its vicinity, is to be excluded, leaving the other two hypotheses to compete between themselves. We have seen that the traditions of diverse peoples offer corroborative testimony to the effect that in a very early age, but still in the memory of mankind, no moon accompanied the Earth. Since human beings already peopled the Earth, it is improbable that the moon sprang from it. There must have existed a solid lithosphere, not a liquid Earth. Thus, while I do not claim to know the origin of the moon, I find it more probable that the moon was captured by the Earth. Such an event would have occurred as a catastrophe. If the moon's formation took place away from the Earth, its composition may be quite different. There is no evidence to suggest whether the moon was a planet, a satellite of another planet, or a comet at the time of its capture by the Earth. Whatever atmosphere it may have had was pulled away by the Earth, by other contacting bodies, or dissipated in some other way. Since the time the moon began to accompany the Earth, it underwent the influence of contacts with comets and planets that passed near the Earth in subsequent ages. The mass of the moon being less than that of the Earth, the moon must have suffered greater disturbances in cosmic contacts. During these contacts, the moon was not carried away. This is due to the fact that no body more powerful than the Earth came sufficiently close to the moon to take it away from the Earth for good, but in the contacts that took place, the moon was removed repeatedly from one orbit to another. The variations in the position of the moon can be read in the variations in the length of the month. The length of the month repeatedly changed in subsequent catastrophic events, and for this there exists a large amount of supporting evidence. In these later occurrences, the moon played a passive role, and Zeus in the Iliad advised it, Aphrodite, to stay out of the battle in which Athena and Ares, Venus and Mars, were the main contestants. A brighter moon. Many traditions persist that at some time in the past the moon was much brighter than it is now, and larger in appearance than the sun. In many rabbinical sources it is stated that the sun and the moon were equally bright at first. The same statement was made to Dasahagun by the aborigines of the New World. The sun and the moon had equal light in the past. At the other end of the world the Japanese asserted the same. The Nihongi Chronicle says that in the past the radiance of the moon was next to that of the sun in splendor. Traditions of many peoples maintain that the moon lost a large part of its light and became much dimmer than it had been in earlier ages. In order that the sun and the moon should give off comparable light, the moon must have had an atmosphere with a high albedo, refracting power, or it must have been much closer to the Earth. In the latter case, the moon would have appeared larger than the sun. In fact, the Babylonian astronomers computed the visible diameter of the sun as only 2/3 of the visible diameter of the moon, which makes a relation of 4:9 for the illuminating surfaces. This measure surprised modern scholars, who are aware of the exactness of the measurements made by the Babylonian astronomers and who reason that during the eclipses one can easily observe the approximate equality of the visible disks. The worship of the moon. Because of its size and also because of the events which accompanied the first appearance of the moon, many ancient peoples regarded the moon as the chief of the luminaries. The sun was of smaller importance than the moon in the eyes of the Babylonian astrologers. The Assyrians and the Chaldeans referred to the time of the moon god as the oldest period in the memory of the people, before other planetary gods came to dominate the world ages. The moon was the supreme deity. Such references are found in the inscriptions of Sargon II, Ka-720, and Nabonidus, Ka-550. The Babylonian Sin, the moon, was a very ancient deity. Mount Sinai owes its name to Sin. The moon, appearing as a body larger than the sun, was endowed by the imagination of the peoples with a masculine role, while the sun was assigned a feminine role. Many languages reserved a masculine name for the moon. It was probably when the moon was removed to a greater distance from the earth and became smaller to observers on the earth, that another name, usually feminine, came to designate the moon in most languages. The Pre-Adamite Age. An ancient tradition ascribed the establishment of moon worship to Adam, the first man. The medieval Arab scholar Abu Basa wrote, "They, the Sabaeans, say that Adam was born from male and female, just like the rest of mankind, but they honored him greatly, and said that he had come from the moon, that he was the prophet and apostle of the moon, and that he had exhorted the nations that they should serve the moon." They also related about Adam that when he had left the moon and proceeded from the area of India towards Babylonia, that he brought many wonders with him. The Adamites, the antediluvial men, were most probably not the first human beings on the planet. Even admitting that by expulsion from the Garden of Eden is allegorized a catastrophe which quite destroyed mankind prior to the deluge, it is impossible to declare that it was the first catastrophe. It depends on the memory of the peoples which catastrophe they consider as the act of creation. Human beings, arising from some catastrophe, bereft of memory of what had happened, regarded themselves as created from the dust of the earth. All knowledge about the ancestors, who they were and in what interstellar space they lived, was wiped away from the memory of the few survivors. The Talmudic rabbinical tradition believes that before Adam was created, the world was more than once inhabited and more than once destroyed. It was at the end of the first age, symbolized by the expulsion of man from the blessed Garden of Eden, that the moon lost its brightness. It was not just a single human pair. The tradition ascribes to Adam the invention of 70 languages. Hebrew mythology assigns to the period preceding Adam's expulsion different geophysical and biological conditions. The sun shone permanently on the earth, and the Garden of Eden, placed in the east, was, it must be conceived, under perpetual rays of the dawn. The earth was not watered by rain, but mist ascending from the ground condensed as dew upon the leaves. The plants looked only to the earth for nourishment. Man was of exceedingly great stature. The dimensions of man's body were gigantic. His appearance was unlike that of later men. His body was overlaid with a horny skin. But a day came and the celestial illumination ceased. The sun had grown dark the instant Adam became guilty of disobedience. The flames of the ever-turning sword terrified Adam, Genesis 3:24. In another legend it is told that the celestial light shone a little in the darkness. And then the celestial light ceased, to the consternation of Adam. The illumination of the first period never returned. The sky that man was used to see never appeared before him again. The firmament is not the same as the heavens of the first day. The day of Genesis, as I have already noted, is said to be equal to 1,000 years. It was after the fall of man, according to Hebrew tradition, that the sun set for the first time. The first time Adam witnessed the sinking of the sun, he was seized with anxious fears. All the night he spent in tears. When day began to dawn, he understood that what he had deplored was but the course of nature. It was also then that the seasons began. This is told in the following story. Adam noticed that the days were growing shorter and feared lest the world be darkened. But after the winter solstice he saw that the days grew longer again. The earth also underwent changes, independent before, she was hereafter to wait to be watered by the rain from above. The variety of species diminished. Man, according to Hebrew legends, decreased in size. There was a vast difference between his later and his former state, between his supernatural size then and his shrunken size now. He also lost his horny skin. The whole of nature altered its ways. Giants. The traditions of peoples all over the world are quite unanimous in asserting that at an earlier time a race of giants lived on the earth, that most of the race were destroyed in great catastrophes, that they were of cruel nature and were furiously fighting among themselves, that the last of them were exterminated when, after a cataclysm, a migration of peoples brought the forebears of the peoples of today to their new homelands. The Japanese narrate that when their forefathers, after a great catastrophe about 2.5 or 3,000 years ago, came from the continent and invaded the isles, they found their long-legged, furry giants. These giants were called Ainu. The forefathers of the Japanese were defeated in the first encounter, but in the second encounter they were victorious. Ixtlilxochitl described the wandering of peoples of the Western Hemisphere in the four ages of the world. The first age came to its end in the flood. In the second age, called the Son of the Earthquake, there lived the generation of the giants, which was destroyed in the cataclysm that terminated this age. The third Byord was the Son of the Wind, called so because at the end of this period terrible hurricanes annihilated everything. The new inhabitants of the new world were Ulm and Zakloka, who came from the east to find a foothold at Potajan. Here they met a number of giants, the last survivors of the second catastrophe. The fourth age was called the Fire Sun, because of the great fire that put an end to this epoch. At that time the Toltecs arrived in the land of Anahuac, put to flight by the catastrophe. They wandered for 104 years before they settled in their new home. Also F. L. Gomara in his Conquista de Mexico, in the chapter about Cinco Sols que Sun Herdades, wrote, "The second sun perished when the sky fell upon the earth. The collapse killed all the people and every living thing, and they say that giants lived in those days, and that to them belong the bones that our Spaniards have found while digging mines and tombs. From their measure and proportion it seems that those men were 20 hands tall, a very great stature, but quite certain." The Hebrew scriptures as preserved in the Old Testament and in the Talmud and Midrashim, narrate that among the races of the world in a previous age were races of giants, men of great size and tremendous strength and ferocity, who were destroying other races, but also were turning upon each other and destroying themselves. The book of Genesis, 6:4, narrates that in the antediluvial time there were giants in the earth in those days. The Greek book of Baruch narrates that over 400,000 of the race of giants were destroyed by the flood. After the flood there were only a few districts where some of them remained alive. When after a number of centuries another catastrophe ruined the world and the Israelites left Egypt and sent a few men to explore Palestine, those reported that the people of the land were generally of tall stature, and that besides there we saw the giants, the sons of Anak, which came of the giants, and we were in our own sight as grasshoppers, and so were we in their sight. This description clearly differentiates between the people of a tall stature and the giants, and the supposition that the Israelites found in Palestine a normal race only taller than themselves, and thought them to be giants, is not supported by the text. A similar distinction is made in Deuteronomy 1:28, "The people is greater and taller than we. And moreover we have seen the sons of the Anakim, giants, they, a few families, lived in Hebron," Numbers 13:22. At the time when the Israelites approached the fields of Bashan in the Transjordan, only Og, king of Bashan, remained of the remnant of the giants, Joshua 13:12 and Dirt 3:11. The other individuals of monstrous size had been annihilated in the meantime. "Behold, his bedstead was a bedstead of iron, is it not in Rabbath of the children of Ammon? 9 cubits is the length thereof, and 4 cubits the breadth of it, after the cubit of man." The text implies that at the time the book of Deuteronomy was written the bedstead of Og was still in existence and was a wonder for the onlookers. The giants were the remnant of a race close to extinction. Og was of the remnant of the giants that dwelt in Ashtoreth and Edrei, Joshua 12:4. They were also called Emim, or the furious ones. The Emim dwelt therein, in Moab of the Transjordan, in times past, a people great and many, and tall as the Anakim, which also were accounted giants, as the Anakim, but Moab calls them Emim. This branch of the giants was already extinct. But 2 cosmic ages earlier, in the days of Mrev, king of Shinar, and Abraham the patriarch, Enum flourished in the Transjordan, Genesis 14, 5. Nephilim. The present state of the Moon and of Mars and other celestial bodies does not imply that in the past they were equally desolate. Concerning Mars and Moon, we have the testimony of our ancestors, supported by modern observations, that these bodies were engaged in near collisions only a few thousand years ago. It is not excluded that under conditions prevailing on their surfaces prior to these events, life could have developed there or elsewhere in the solar system to an advanced stage. Working in the early 1940s on worlds in collision, which in its original form covered also the cataclysmic events preceding the Exodus, I wondered at a certain description that sounded like a visit from space. The sixth chapter of the book of Genesis starts this way. And it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God, Nephilim, saw the daughters of men that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose. The story told in Genesis via about the sons of God, Nephilim, coming to the daughters of men is usually explained as referring to an advanced priesthood that mingled with backward tribesmen. When Columbus discovered America, the natives, according to the diary of his first voyage, regarded him and his crew as having arrived from the sky. A similar occurrence could have taken place in pre-diluvial times, when some invaders from a remote part of the world came and were regarded as sons of God. But if we are today on the eve of interplanetary travel, we must not declare as absolutely impossible the thought that this Earth was visited, ages ago, by some people from another planet. Or was this Earth alone populated by intelligent beings? In my understanding, this passage from the book of Genesis is a literary relic dealing with a visit of intelligent beings from another planet. It appears that the extraterrestrial visitors made their landing as if in advance knowledge of the impending catastrophe of the deluge. It could be that Jupiter and Saturn were approaching each other ever closer on their orbits and that a disruption of one of them was expected. Possibly many centuries, or even millennia, passed between the landing and the deluge. The mission could have been undertaken to ascertain the conditions on Earth. If it was an escape, it could also have been from another catastrophe in the solar system, one of those that preceded the deluge, like the one described as the dethronement and emasculation of Uranus by Cronos. If the ancient legends of a battle between the gods and Titans, so persistent in the Greek world, but also in the mythologies of other civilizations, have any historical value, we may try to find what may have been the substratum of this fantasy. It seems that following great convulsions of nature observable in the celestial sphere, giant bodies were hurled on the earth. They arrived burned and were crushed by impact. But at least one group of escapees succeeded in safely reaching the earth. They descended on Mount Hermon or Anti-Lebanon. Of the extra-biblical traditions dealing with the subject, some reach hoary antiquity, antecedent to the composition of the biblical texts. The Book of Enoch narrates that the group was composed of males only, 200 in number, under the leadership of one by the name of Shemhazai. The Agadic literature says that the sons of God tried to return to heaven from where they had come, but could not. The new arrivals were probably of gigantic stature. Their progeny with women of the earth were giants. The Nephilim were on earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. These were the mighty men that were of old, the men of renown. Having fathered giants, they themselves must have been not of human size. The planet from which they came I would not know to determine. L would refer to Saturn. The great size of the visitors would suggest a smaller body where the gravitational influence would be less. 10,000 years is only an instant in the life of the cosmos. 10,000 years ago man was only in a rude stone age, today he contemplates to visit other planets. If such progress is made in a time as short as this, who knows what secrets are concealed in the past or in the future. Astronomical knowledge before the deluge. In the deluge, civilization was destroyed, the real value of which is incalculable. Hebrew tradition estimates that the population of the antediluvian world amounted to millions. Adam is said to have invented 70 languages. Cain, his son, built cities and monuments and ruled over kings. They were representatives of generations. According to Hebrew legends, the deluge and its time had already been predicted by Enoch, and even more ancient generations were said to have erected tablets with calendric and astronomical calculations predicting the catastrophe. This might have been the knowledge of months, of years, and of the periods of comets that the remote generations had acquired. It was in the celestial harmony and disharmony that the secrets of the upheavals were conceived to lie. The science about the times in which calamity could return in full on our earth was cultivated among populations that had a vivid remembrance of days of misfortune or of lucky escape. It is told about the children of Seth, the son of Adam, that they were the inventors of that peculiar sort of wisdom which is concerned with the heavenly bodies and their order. And that their inventions might not be lost before they were sufficiently known, they made two pillars upon Adam's prediction that the world was to be destroyed at one time by the force of fire and at another time by the violence and quantity of water. The one was of brick, the other of stone, and they inscribed their discoveries on both, that in case the pillar of brick should be destroyed by the flood, the pillar of stone might remain, and exhibit these discoveries to mankind and also inform them that there was another pillar, of brick, erected by them. This means that stelae with calendric and astronomical calculations were made public knowledge in that early age. According to the Agada, it was the pious Enoch, the seventh generation, who achieved the deepest knowledge of the celestial secret. He was the man who walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. In this ascension to heaven was taken away the man who more than any other knew the plan of the world and of its creation. Enoch was a great man of his generation. Kings and princes, not less than 130 in number, assembled about him, and submitted themselves to his dominion, to be taught and guided by him. Peace reigned thus over the whole world for all the 243 years during which the influence of Enoch prevailed. In the story of Enoch's ascension, it is said that he predicted the disaster. Enoch was carried into the heavens in a fiery chariot drawn by fiery chargers. The day thereafter, the kings who had turned back in good time sent messengers to inquire into the fate of the men who had refused to separate themselves from Enoch, for they had noted the number of them. They found snow and great hailstones upon the spot whence Enoch had risen, and, when they searched beneath, they discovered the bodies of all who had remained behind with Enoch. He alone was not among them, he was high in heaven. What the Agada means to tell is that a human being, and one gifted with the greatest wisdom concerning the heavenly bodies and their order, was brought away in a fiery storm which killed many, brought snow and meteorites, and which had been predicted by the one who disappeared. Some exact knowledge of the revolution of the bodies in the sky is ascribed here to the antediluvian generations. Deluge. The scriptural deluge is regarded by historians and critical exegetes as a legendary product. The legend of a universal deluge is in itself a myth and cannot be anything else. It is most nakedly and unreservedly mythological. The tradition of a universal deluge is told by all ancient civilizations, and also by races that never reached the ability to express themselves in the written symbols of a language. It is found all over the world, on all continents, on the islands of the Pacific and Atlantic, everywhere. Usually it is explained as a local experience carried from race to race by word of mouth. The work of collating such material has repeatedly been done, and it would only fatigue the reader were I to repeat these stories as told in all parts of the world, even in places never visited by missionaries. The rest of the collected traditions are also not identical in detail, and are sometimes very different in their setting from the Noah story, but all agree that the earth was covered to the mountain tops by the water of the deluge coming from above, and that only a few human beings escaped death in the flood. The stories are often accompanied by details about a simultaneous cleavage of the earth. In pre-Columbian America, the story of a universal flood was very persistent. The First World Age was called Atonasha, or the age that was brought to its end by a universal deluge. This is written and illustrated in the ancient codices of the Mexicans and was narrated to the Spaniards who came to the new continent. The natives of Australia, Polynesia, and Tasmania, discovered in the 17th century, related almost identical traditions. Clay tablets with inscriptions concerning the early ages and the deluge were found in Mesopotamia. Their similarity to the biblical account, and to the story of the Chaldean priest Berossus who lived in the Hellenistic age, caused a great sensation at the end of the last century and the beginning of the current one. On this sensational discovery was based the sensational pamphlet Babel und Bibel by Friedrich Delitzsch, 1902, who tried to show in it that the Hebrews had simply borrowed this story, along with many others, from the Babylonian store of legends. But if here and there the story of the flood could be said to have been borrowed by the scriptural writer from the Babylonians, and by some natives from the missionaries, in other cases no such explanation could be offered. The indigenous character of the stories in many regions of the world makes the borrowing theory seem very fragile. Geologists see vestiges of diluvial rains all over the world. Folklorists hear the story of a universal flood wherever folklore is collected. Historians read of a universal flood in American manuscripts, in Babylonian clay tablets, and in the annals of practically all cultured peoples. But the climatologists make it very clear that even should the entire water content of the atmosphere pour down as rain, the resulting flood could not have covered even the lowland slopes, far less the peaks of the mountains, as all accounts insist that this deluge did. William Whiston and the Deluge. The years 1680 and 1682 were years of unusually bright comets. Many pamphlets were printed, especially in Germany, on the imminent end of the world. At the very least, great catastrophes were expected. There was nothing new in such prognostications. In earlier centuries and also earlier in the 17th century, comets were regarded with awe and every possible evil effect was ascribed to them. Thus a scholarly author, David Herlesius, published in 1619 a discourse on a comet that had appeared shortly before, in 1618, and enumerated the calamities that this comet, and comets in general, bring with them or presage. Desiccation of the crops and barrenness, pestilence, great stormy winds, great inundations, shipwrecks, defeat of armies or destruction of kingdoms, decease of great potentates and scholars, schisms and rifts in religion, etc. The portents of comets are threefold, in part natural, in part political, and in part theological. David Herlesius also quoted Cicero, "From the remotest remembrance of antiquity it is known that comets have always presaged disasters." The fear and even horror caused by the comet of 1680 was just beginning to calm down when in 1682 another great comet appeared. Edmund Halley was 26 years old when this comet of 1682 appeared. He had experience in astronomical observations and calculations, having spent time on the island of St. Helena, cataloguing the 341 southern stars. He had observed the transit of Mercury, and made pendulum observations. Now he calculated the orbit of the comet of 1682, and predicted its return in 1759. Actually, the periodicity of comets was not first discovered by Halley. The ancient authors knew that comets have their time of revolution. Seneca wrote in his treatise De Cometis, in some respects still the most advanced discussion of this subject, that the Chaldeans counted the comets among the planets. A comet with a periodicity of about 70 years was known to the rabbis. Nevertheless, only little aware of the works of the ancients, the modern world acclaimed Halley to be the discoverer of the periodicity of comets. However, this acclaim came only after his prognostication realized itself. The comet of 1682, or Halley's comet, returned in 1759. It came somewhat retarded on account of its passage near the planets Jupiter and Saturn. This delay had been calculated, though not quite accurately, by Halley. On the grave of Halley these words are engraved: "Under this marble peacefully rests Edmundus Hallius, LL.D., unquestionably the greatest astronomer of his age." But when Halley offered his theory of the periodicity of comets, and of the return of the observed comet after 75 years, this theory was not received immediately with enthusiasm. Yet in the mind of a contemporary mathematician, the idea of a periodic return of comets was the beginning of the broadly developed theory of the origin of the world and of the nature of the deluge.